This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
They say these are the movies that we shouldn't be watching, but we'll decide for ourselves. This is the Movie Dude Eric, along with me are...
This is Kent.
And this is John O'Labster.
And this is Art House Rejects. This episode we're discussing Escape from Tomorrow, starring Roy Abramson, Elena Shuber, Caitlin Rodriguez, Jack Dalton, Daniel Safidi, and directed by Randy Moore. Gentlemen, welcome to the end of Art House Rejects. I don't know if there was any other movie that we could possibly end this on. To kind of cap everything off, and I have to say, I didn't expect this for our viewer selection, and believe it or not, we actually got a special guest with us.
The viewer, our listener.
Yes, it's Jesse!
Hi!
Woo-hoo. Woo-hoo.
So happy to be here.
We're actually happy to be that you're here with us as well, because I know that you've been with us for a while.
And, from the beginning.
Yes, and I have to admit that I was really happy that you're the winner of the of our little competition that we had late last year.
Why?
And
thank you.
I have to admit, I know that as soon as you gave us your pick, that you made the day of at least one of us in on the cast. And
was it me?
No,
I think it was you.
Yeah, it was me. Because I've seen this before.
Yes, you did. And I remember that little conversation that we had about that. Because I also saw it before. And my jaw was agape after I saw that movie. Going to see this movie again, I don't know if I should be flabbergasted or frustrated or thankful or whatever. I will say one thing, though. This is not a movie. This is the proof that interdimensional travel is possible. And I'll get into that as we talk about this movie.
Right.
Fascinating.
Yes. I thought so, too, after I watched the movie this time. So, so let's go ahead and let's get into this, because I know that I have a whole lot to talk about.
Sure.
Now, for Art House Rejects, I know that we've kind of had a thing where we've been allowing someone to kind of give us a recap of the movie.
Yes.
And I was wondering, since my apologies, since Jesse, you are the guest of honor, would you like to do a recap in your own words of Escape from Tomorrow?
Please.
It would be my pleasure.
Explain it to me.
So explain it to you. I will do my best. So on the very last day of what seems to have been a decent vacation, I believe his name is Jim.
Yes.
Jim gets the worst phone call of his life. He has lost his job from a boss who gives no explanation. This is the beginning of what would probably be a meltdown of sorts, as he takes his family, a wife, two children, a boy and a girl, into Disney World for what should be the last day of just fun and frivolity. Instead, each ride is just one nightmare after another, while he stalks a pair of French teenagers who inexplicably appear everywhere, only to finally spiral into a fever dream of nightmarish proportions that leaves us with a nuclear blast at Epcot Center, only to learn was all a nightmare, ending with our character's final demise in what I can only say is the least favorite death in a movie I have ever seen.
All right, so let me go ahead and start us off with what I think is possibly the most obvious thing I could say about this movie. This is the most David Lynchian movie that we've had so far this year, and we actually did a David Lynch movie
too
just last week.
I was thinking the same thing. David Lynch. How David Lynch of it. And I still can't wrap my head around it.
Well, it's David Lynch fought Kyle MacLachlan. That would be weird.
Before we do like the plot, and I feel like that was a pretty good synopsis, Jesse. Like I feel like we have to talk about how this movie was made before we kind of unpack what
Do you mind? Would you mind if I just jumped in with my introduction to the film?
Yeah, sure, go ahead. Sure.
I first heard about the movie on the Nerdist podcast and could not wait to see it. I bought it on Blu-ray the week it came out, excited to watch an independent film filmed in such a way that it qualified under parody law and Disney could do nothing about it, even though they really wanted to, and just hoped that it would quietly go away. And I don't like ambiguity in my movies. I need an ending that means something. I need an explanation. But after viewing it multiple times, I'll watch it again. We'll say that.
Yes, we'll get into this. Okay. It wasn't the Nerdist podcast for me. It was actually Roger Ebert's review that made me familiar with this. And a secondary review from the Slash Filmcast, where they talked about just how crazy and twisted this movie was. And I was kind of curious, even though this was before I actually had a trip to Disney and, was kind of an anti-Disney at that particular point. So I was kind of curious, they stuck it to the man, kind of thing. But, when I saw this movie, this is going to take a while for me to get into. But
there is so much here to unpack.
Right. But yes. I mean, let's just talk for a second. I just wanted to talk about like the logistics of how they filmed the movie.
Yes.
Because, I mean, what we really haven't said out loud, at least so far, like we've talked that it was set at Disneyland, but it was filmed at Disneyland.
Gorilla
Disney,
style.
Disney World? Are we in Florida? Yes. We in Orlando? Okay.
It was
Disney World, right?
To my knowledge, it was filmed both places.
It was filmed in both places.
That would make sense.
Bits of it were filmed on both coasts.
Okay.
Yes, but it was set in Disney World.
Right.
Yes.
In Orlando. Because they say it's Florida. So it was filmed guerrilla style, and by this we mean on like Canon handheld cameras.
Yep, on location without approval, and if they ever got caught, all of the footage would be lost.
Well, so Disney has, like the parks, they will let you obviously take pictures of you and your family and stuff of your visit, and they are fairly lax about like you posting the, our family vacation to Disneyland. Like if you post it on YouTube, they're not going to like crack down on you.
That's part of their economy. One of the things I found out, after my trip to Disney and I started to actually be kind of curious about this whole thing is that, Disney requires as much about word of mouth as it does with any of their advertising.
Right.
Because they know that people who come from Disney usually have a very positive thing. And so they want the YouTube. They want it on social media. Right. They want people to post their stuff. In fact,
their friends and relatives also book trips.
Yes.
After seeing the good time that they had.
Well, I mean, even this movie calls it, it's like, about even the boss's son said nothing but good stuff about Soren.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of like that. It's all, I mean, not want to say all word of mouth, but as much as they get off of those commercials, it has nothing on the word of mouth. And
right.
If you've ever been there, you understand why the word of mouth is as high as it is.
But to make this movie a reality, they had to do all of their filming there in the park as surreptitiously as possible, because like you said, it's not necessarily that they're taking video or filming or anything, but the fact that they are doing lines and filming a movie and all of that. And so they had, instead of carrying script pages, they had their lines on their iPhones so they could just kind of glance down at their phones. It didn't look too suspicious. They filmed on those Canon cameras that don't look like video cameras. They're like regular, like SLR cameras, but they can shoot in digital video.
I shorthand is handy cam.
See the Vice episode on Escape from Tomorrow, where they kind of go behind the scenes and they show kind of how he did it? It's on YouTube right now.
I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting.
And so, but like, it's even more complex than that because, okay, so the movie's in black and white, which we kind of know, is because they couldn't really control lighting and focus all that well. They decided to shoot monochrome, which they actually shot They like customized the settings on their camera, so they actually filmed in black and white. So it's like there can never be a color cut of this film.
Without Technicolor.
They'd have to go in and colorize everything.
I'll be honest here, it would be awesome if they actually did like the Disney Technicolor kind of thing, like
Mary
Poppins.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Oh, and God, that would be... Disney can make money off of that, you know? It's like have their own cut of it, you know, make some money off of it.
I kind of want to do that
to ILM.
Remember how we cast the remake of Dune last week? We should do the big budget version of Escape from Tomorrow.
If Nicolas Cage isn't cast in this movie somewhere, then there's no God.
And so they had to, like,
brought back terrible memories of Wicker Man.
I love Wicker Man.
They had to figure out, like, literally scientifically the position of the sun so they knew, like, what time of day to shoot so they could make the lighting kind of match up from day to day. They had to ride around on the people mover for hours just to do the scene where they pass each other. So, like, a lot of crazy stuff went into filming this. And then I think they did have some sets that they used, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And green screen.
There
was quite a bit of
stuff. Yeah. So
very
jarring.
Noticeable.
I think they had $650,000 to make this movie.
And 300,000 of it was admission to the park.
Yeah. Well, geez.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Are you serious?
But it's expensive, and there's a lot of people to get in.
Yeah. I would not have. That sounded totally believable. You could have just said, "Yep, absolutely," and I would.
Yeah. If you count up the full cast and whoever's on camera and sound, right. For how many? Do we know how many days they filmed?
Well, they probably filmed for, I would say, if they used most of their time appropriately, they could have done it probably within about a week.
Yeah, at least. They would need at least a week, I think, to do it. Because they have stuff at night, and they have all kinds of stuff during the day, and you can really only shoot certain times of the day to get the light just right. But I think kind of the flip side of that is when you look at the type of movie that this is, a lot of stuff is out of focus. It's weird angles. It's trippy. It kind of works for the movie that they made.
Oh, yeah. Well, the way they filmed some of the rides real up close in his face, in our face, and I don't know, and even the music, you know, the music that sounds vaguely familiar but isn't Disney music.
That's actually the biggest copyright issue that they had. It wasn't showing the rides. Well, besides saying D bleep, that they couldn't say that, but they could
say Simmons for some reason.
Yeah, Simmons. Yeah. Demons, they could do that.
Technically speaking, Geo, it's not like they can get away around that.
Geosporic, I guess. They kind of had to make that one up. But the music was one of the big intellectual property thing is the music. So they had to write new music that could go along with the ride, but like you said, be vaguely familiar.
Well, what they needed to do was have something that they could mix into the because they had to use a lot of the original sound, and they had to cover up a lot of the music that was playing. You know, especially like It's a Small World. They couldn't use It's a Small World, so they had to have music that they could put over it that doesn't. Contrast or, you know, kind of make it
into break they didn't break the illusion.
Yeah. So what it was is that they had to find a way to have a score that would be able to complement the music that's already there, but to twist it enough that they could get around copyright. But if you notice a lot of the music, it does kind of, but it, at the same time, if you really listen, I mean, if you can, you know, just, you know, put the sound up or put on headphones or something, you can hear a little of the original music in there.
Creeping in.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I never caught that.
Yeah. But this was the second time around when I was really paying attention to the music at this point.
And I guess for me, okay, now we kind of need to get this out in the open right now. I have never been to the Disney parks, either one of them, in my life.
Anybody else that has or hasn't been to the Disney parks?
I went to Disney World at 10, so 20-something years ago.
I went at like 5, nice. Which knowing how old I am, that's even longer.
Well, I went last summer, or not last summer, but 2014. And I'm going again next year because my daughter's going to be old enough to really enjoy this stuff. But I guess since I'm the one that's been
You're
there
the most recent visitor.
Yes.
You're the most recent escapee from tomorrow.
Believe it. Okay, let me explain a little bit about my history with Disney. Now, I've enjoyed Disney movies just like anybody else, but I've never considered myself to be a huge fan of Disney. And when this trip came around, I was kind of one of the, okay, I'll go, but it wasn't something I was really looking forward to. The moment you step into the park, I'm not kidding here, you regress in age. Like, I can understand why people get as giddy as they do over this park. And it was one of those things where, you know, it's just, I've never experienced anything like it before in my life. And it's something that I'm not going to go every chance I get, but, you know, it's just like, wow, I can see the attraction that this film has with Disney and why it has this kind of a skewed look at the park, specifically because the park is designed to sell happiness. It is the happiest place on earth. It is sold like that, and everything about it is definitely trying to get you to forget the outside world. To me, this does a better job than Vegas. In doing that. And wow, I mean, the way that they show it, and I love how they start off with giving you kind of a look at Disney, getting a look at the people who are enjoying themselves, you know, some of the rides before we have a decapitation, but you know, just having this kind of joyful, fun look, seeing people having a good time, because we're gonna have that stripped away little by little, right? We're going to kind of get deeper into the insanity. Now, I don't want to say that this is a movie that's anti-Disney. If anything, this is a loving parody of Disney.
Well, and also for any institution that is as much in the public eye as something like a major theme park, that has its own history and all of that, there are a whole host of urban legends that arise surrounding that institution. And I feel like this...
Like frozen heads in the basement?
Yeah, you know, stuff like that. And I feel like this film... And again, I don't know that much about Disney urban legends, but I feel like it's having fun with the idea that there is kind of this mythology and hidden history behind someplace like that.
That's true. I will say also when it comes to the setting of this film, it does eerily have it, especially considering that I've been very recently. It does look like Disney. It doesn't look like a facsimile. It looks like, you know, if you were to watch this movie, you could actually use it as a map around the park. But
so you feel like the geography matches up?
I do, and
that's kind of what I wondered watching it, because they talk about like, okay, well we're gonna run back to the hotel and take a nap, and then we'll meet up with you and all of that, and I kind of wondered, because I know that the parks themselves are enormous.
They are.
And there's more than, there's what, five or six now? Different?
Right now there are four, and they're building two more.
Yeah.
The one that I think all of us are all eager for, you know, with a certain galaxy far, far away.
Uh-huh.
Well, now that you bring it up, what I was going to say is this speaks to one of the few problems that I did have with the movie, which was just the unbelievability of running into the same half a dozen people 7-8 times over the course of what looks like a 16-hour day.
I've experienced that in real life. Anybody ever taken a cruise?
Negative.
Okay, if you're on a cruise ship, here's the funny thing. If you're on a cruise ship, you know, obviously you're in a contained environment, but still there are thousands of people on board the ship. You would not believe the number of times that you run into like the same three people in the course of the trip. And it's just one of those weird things that What is it, Bader-Meinhof syndrome, where once you hear about something, then you start recognizing it, or once you see something, like, or, you know, you buy the car and then you see the same car everywhere when you're out on the road because you're now kind of like attuned to looking at it.
Well, that's true, but when it comes to Disney, and you have to understand the size.
Right. That's, yeah.
I mean, again, we're talking about like running into the same three people in Manhattan. That's the difference in scope. And
right.
I understand where you're coming from. Now, here's my explanation about that specifically. Is, first off, we're in David Lynch territory, so
yeah,
all bets are off when it comes to that aspect.
Right.
But second of all, he's stalking those girls.
He is definitely following the girl.
He's stalking.
Sure.
They established very early on that he's definitely
them?
A creeper. And yeah, the son even says, why are we following them? Oh, well they just like
the same
rides as we do.
I love it when the wife says, they're young even for you.
Indicating that he has a history with younger women.
Well, exactly. You know, when he gets a call that he's getting fired, and the second time around, I actually came up with this idea, which is that the reason he was fired was because he's that jerk in the office that is telling the really, bad, deplorable jokes.
He's the human resources nightmare.
Yeah, I get the sense that he's the one that likes to stare at women's chests all day. He does come off as kind of a bro, right? I mean, okay, first off, you're at Disney World, you're with your family, you got in bad news, but you're supposedly trying to tough it out to let everyone have a good day, and yet almost from the moment you get on the frickin' monorail, you're just stalking these two girls. And we're not talking about like two girls that are showing active interest in him. Bear in mind, if anything, they kind of look like they're together, like together. And yet he is like freaking following around like a wolf, you know, with his tongue out.
Right.
You know, like a Tex Avery wolf at that. You know, it's like
there's a definite sense of preoccupation with these ladies.
We'll get into this because we also get the sense almost from the first moment we see him when he's out on the balcony, everything is not well with him. He just lost his job, true, but we also know that he is kind of in a rut with his wife, if not serious trouble. And we, from the moment in the tunnel. When he's trying to get a kiss and she won't give him kisses, we get the sense that we're serious trouble, you know, like close to like marriage ending trouble, which gives an indication there. He is sexually frustrated. He's getting nothing at home. So you definitely get that sense of that he's looking to,
Yeah, the marriage isn't good. For him, and you see definite signs when you see their interactions that they're not at the full level of functioning in their relationship.
There's even a moment where his wife mentions, "Did you black out again?" Like this is some kind of an ongoing problem. Well, before the movie is established.
I honestly think it's because he drinks, because when he, as we see, he has no problem getting extremely toasted in public and in a place like Disney of all places. I mean, this is, again, he's supposedly trying to, you know, to give everyone a one last good day before reality kicks in. And anyone who's been to Disney, that moment of like reality coming back to, coming back.
When it's time to go home.
Yeah.
Well, but is it he's trying to give it, is he trying to make it better for everyone else, or is he trying to make it better for him, or what he perceives is better for everyone else?
Well, because the thing is that he obviously doesn't care about Disney World. You get the sense he doesn't like it. This is not his thing. He's, you know, he's there specifically just for his family, and he's just hanging back and just, you know, letting them have the fun. We got a sense,
which they would have had if he had not interfered.
Yes and no, because we also get a sense that Emily is a real control freak, and that there's some serious issues between her and their daughter. We get the sense that each parent has a favorite. that the mother has an affection for the son. We get that from the beginning because the son locks out the father on the balcony, and then he gets into bed and snuggles up with mom. Every time we see him, he's favoring one parent over the other. The daughter,
it's almost Oedipus complex.
Yes and no. The daughter and the mom have issues going on because every time that the mother is talking to the daughter, it's always a lot more combative than with the son. We get the sense that the father definitely favors the daughter over the son. Well, obviously because the son is very combative. But you also get the sense that there's that of his entire family, Jim connects to his daughter more than the others in his family. But what do y'all take on this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like, so the good kind of relationships are the mother with the son and the father with the daughter. The father and the mother aren't getting along. We don't honestly get that much between the two children. We see them kind of splashing in the pool together and they're having a good time, but that's the only time we see them together. Well, kind of when they're in the bathtub too. They're kind of getting along and the mom's giving them a bath, but the mother has to like wrestle the daughter into the bath. She has to wrestle her to get the sunscreen, and then she ends up hitting her. We see that later in the film. The father has, like, he's clearly trying with the son, but the son just isn't having it. He locks him out on the patio. When they're kind of stuck together, the father ends up dragging him around to all the rides just to follow the girls. And then he ends up, you know, taking him on the ride that ends up making him sick and he has to throw up in the trash can. So now he really is not a fan of dad at the moment. And that continues on to the very end of the film.
What about you, Kent? What are you taking on all this?
I wasn't sure if some of the family issues were happening before the trip started, or is this just bringing out the worst? Because
no, you bring your baggage to vacation. It doesn't start there.
Yeah, but
I mean, the Griswolds, these people are not.
Yeah, they are not in this for a quest to have fun. They're like,
Jesse, go ahead. I will bring up one last thing, but I want to give you a chance to chime in on this.
Well, and I'm with you and Kent, where it seems like there was clearly baggage to begin with. We see the moment in the pool where he goes, "Oh, hey, I got you this thing," and she just reads in the riot act that it is the wrong thing. But then I had to rethink it and go, "Well, you did just pull a gift out of your trunks in the middle of a pool."
Dumbo, really? Dumbo?
Yeah.
Well, so it makes you wonder.
Oh, you think I look like Emily Dickinson?
It makes you wonder just how much kind of crap like that he pulls. You know, he's trying to do something sweet, but his timing is all wrong.
Do you feel like they were on the ropes to start with, and they took this trip?
Yeah.
Thinking maybe
this will be the thing.
Yeah. This will help. We just need some time away as a family so we can all bond together and. Clearly, taking a super stressful vacation will be the way to do that.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, you had said earlier that she really strikes you as a control freak. But like, I have to look at it from the other perspective of, yeah, you do something asinine like pull a gift out of your trunks.
Well, and if she doesn't,
it's not just that. I mean, from the moment we see her,
if she doesn't control it, who will though? Because clearly, he's not stepping up.
Well, that might be their thing, their relationship thing that says she's kind of the one that's controlling things and he's kind of, the kind of enforcer. But the reason why I'm calling her a control freak isn't so much kind of the role that's forced upon her. You get the sense that she actually kind of enjoys it, especially how she's barking orders to everyone as they're coming out of the hotel room. She's the one that's saying, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And when she doesn't have control, such as when the daughter wants to stay at the park, she gets mad. Yeah. She gets really mad when she has no control over anything. Yeah. And these little smaller details that I think makes this story a little bit more deeper than I think that a lot of people will give it credit for. The problem here is this movie doesn't know what direction it wants to go in at all. I mean, if anything, I like to think of it that this movie actually has six different stories going on, and not one of them is seen through to completion.
It's
what
like
would you
going,
even call it?
Well, you know what? It's like going to Disney World, because you want to sample a little bit of everything. And when you do that, of course, you're not going to get to see everything, and you're not going to have a cohesive narrative. But you want to experience everything, because you've really only got one more day to do it. So you just get a little bit of everything in there.
Okay, well, let's see here. Let's look at the various storylines that we got going on here. We've got a man that is on the verge because he's losing his family. He's losing he lost his job. So we have that particular storyline. We also have a guy that a man that's lusting after young women at the at the expense of loved ones. We have
although to be fair, he does give sexual attention to his wife, which she rebuffs at every turn.
It's
usually at a completely inappropriate time, but
is there really
trying? There's no better time than in a tunnel. I'm sorry, that's
the
reason
the
why it's called
love.
The tunnel of love. Come on. I mean, and they have their own boat. It's not like the kids are like right in the middle. They have, this is the perfect time. She doesn't want it. She is not interested. She is in mom mode. She is in control mode. And he is, and his advances are being blocked. Again, we're looking at kind of the end of the relationship.
Right.
But we also have, let's see here.
Let's keep ticking them off.
All right, we have the robot apocalypse that's going on. We have the biological hazard that's going on.
Cat flu.
We have the, let's see here.
N2H4, I think it was, or something like
that. Yeah, we have the conflict with others at the park that never gets resolved.
Are you talking about the guy in the wheelchair and his son?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, they show up and there's no payoff. There's no finality in any of this. It just feels like every day that they went to shoot something on the film, they had a completely different script. And like, okay, we're going to do it this way now. Oh, no, you know what? We're going to do it this way now. Oh, we're going to do it this way now.
Well, okay, there's the former Disney princess lives in the presidential suite, has a mind control necklace, and may or may not be a witch.
Well, I think that.
Or is she a succubus or what?
No, like, I think that she's using the energies of the park to her own evil advantage.
Very well.
Again, if one of the things that really struck me is how magic has, in order for magic to work, you have to believe in it. And if there's one place that would definitely have that kind of magical power, it's Disney, because it relies on the magic of nostalgia. It relies on the magic of imagination. It relies on people completely giving in to their inner child, which is a very innocent place for people, and they will allow themselves to get kind of sucked in. And we have this guy that's been kind of resisting this throughout the movie, and for him to be kind of lured by this energy against his will, specifically. Again, this would have been very interesting if they would have given it more time and energy, especially considering that she is able to charm him into her bed, specifically.
Well, I think she does that to everybody. There are turkey legs that aren't really turkey, man. It's emu.
Yeah.
Is that one of the park myths, or is that actually a thing?
Emus are huge. That would, I know. If that was an emu leg, it's a baby emu.
Google. Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, but the things that I really appreciate about this is the blurring of the magic and the reality, which I think is something that you can definitely do at Disney. Can I use
a different word?
Sure.
Imagination. Because that's a word and a theme that keeps coming up again and again. And the people who work at Disney and plan the rides and everything aren't called engineers. They're called Imagineers.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is something that I think is worthwhile to kind of unpack in regards to this movie, because I feel like when we talk about things like magic and sci-fi and all of that, Not to mention, again, parallel dimensions kind of gets pulled into it at the end. How big a role does imagination play in this film? And is this a setting in which your imagination can kind of run wild? And that's what we see kind of play out on screen. If you want to take the perspective that this is a story about someone who is losing their mind, that all of this kind of factors into how, like, someone losing their mind is going to kind of go through all of these stages, and they're going to go through the paranoia. They're going to go through the germophobia, the weird sexual lusting, and everything that kind of goes into what happens at the end of the film, and at the end develop a new personality.
Could we say that perhaps that it's kind of a mix of, when I say magic, I don't mean in kind of the Lord of the Rings realm. I'm thinking more on the ability of the mind to make anything into something supernatural. And, you know, that mixing of magic and imagination. And that makes a lot of sense for the cat flu thing, because, again, we don't really know what cat flu is. It's a passing phrase. And so
it means no worries for the rest of your days.
That's kind of my.
I thought it was a stand-in for bird flu, since you know that was supposed to kill everyone a few years ago.
Yeah, and there was a big fear, especially at parks like that, you know, where you have everyone getting together from all over the world.
Now it's measles.
Yeah, because anti-vaxxers. But cat flu. It's clearly affecting a lot of people, because even the nurse at the park was breaking down and crying about the cat flu casualties. So there's that. And we totally glossed over the fact that Disney princesses are actually high-priced courtesans to rich Asian businessmen who will pay thousands for one in costume.
This again speaks to the part of the things about the movie that I did actually, I don't know, want to say enjoyed, but appreciated.
Yeah.
The overweight slob, the cat flu, the constantly running into he's bumping into people constantly, and he's not really sure what's going on. And there's never a clear line between delusion or hallucination and reality. It evoked for me the absolute worst of going to any amusement park. Yes. And I don't know if this movie qualifies as horror, but there are bits and pieces in the movie that straight up horrified me.
Yeah. I think it definitely falls in the horror category, especially the like body horror of what he kind of goes through. Even that bit with the toe, just it's like gross, and the gloop, and the part where he puts the sock on the hand dryer. That kills me, but I'm also like, if you see that guy in the bathroom, you are not washing your hands. We're not washing hands? No, let's get out of here.
Let us get away from this crazy man as quickly as we can. God damn it, why did we come here?
Yeah.
Well, the thing that surprises me when I was at Disney specifically is that you have so many different people, so many different nationalities, so many different, this thing draws, you know, people from halfway across the planet to this place.
Right.
And so you're going to get some very different people together in the same place. And I kind of wish that there was a way that they would have been able to bring that out specifically. I mean, with the guy that's in the wheelchair, he has a British-ish accent.
I thought he was kind of like
Southern.
Southern.
It sounded Cajun almost.
Yeah.
Louisiana.
Yeah. Hello, honey. I'm really terrible at that, but
yeah.
Yeah. Your new,
I get the idea. Yeah.
He was from down the deep south way.
I don't know. I mean, the first time I heard it, I thought it was kind of more British. You see a lot of different nationalities.
Right.
And I'll say for my particular experience very recently, I don't think that there was a whole lot of this when y'all were down there. But there's a lot of people on those go-karts. A lot.
You mean the scooters or the...
Yeah, the scooters. Like,
scooters. Okay. There's a lot of people at Walmarts on those, so...
Yeah.
But, okay,
and,
so...
Well, okay, well, my dad used to use one of those a lot, and we had two of them for a while, because used at work, one of those. And if you own one, you get really good at controlling it. Mm-hmm. If you don't own one and just like, they have them here and I'm going to borrow one, you could tell who owns one and who just uses one. And the people who just use them are always hitting everything. because they don't care and they just don't practice on them.
We're not trying to throw shade on the cart drivers. I think the big takeaway for me from all of this is you've got all of these people, all of these different nationalities, everyone different age, different place, all walks of life, but they're all expected to be happy. Because this is the happiest place on earth. And God damn it, if you're not happy here, what the hell is wrong with you?
Well, okay, so another thing about Disney I have to bring up, and it's relevant to this particular line of thinking, is that every person that that works there is the nicest, sweetest people on the planet. And it is a bit disturbing.
Stepford-ish?
Not really, because it's not as though they're like animatronics or anything. They're actually genuinely nice and sweet. And, of course, when you find out exactly how much some of these people are making, I can understand why they jump and do songs and backflips and stuff like that.
Well, yeah.
But, I mean, the thing is that, you don't have one person that you see, and they deeply discourage it, that comes to work with a bad attitude. It doesn't happen.
Right.
And so, because you're expected, especially if you ever go to Disney and then you decide to go like the Universal Studios, that the difference is night and day, by just how the people behave there. You know, like the people who work at Universal, it's a job. For people who work at Disney, this is a lifelong ambition. You get the sense that that the princesses would play princesses forever if they could, by their energy.
And that's that's something that comes through in this movie, is you have someone who maybe could never quite give up that feeling of
I don't think she ever was, to be honest. I got the sense that she kind of has Annie Wilkes syndrome.
She's kind of like the Joker. Let me tell you how I got these scars, and every version of the origin isn't true.
Well, I don't want to say it's a Joker thing. I think it's more that she's the one of the people that wishes that she could have been one of the Disney princesses. Yeah. And so she's been living out this particular fantasy for a very, very, very long time, to the point where she's Michael Jacksoning people's kids.
I would go so far as to say she's the person that showed up in a knockoff costume and pretended.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably.
And there's a lot of people who do that. A lot of people who go full out at Disney and they get invested. I think that the filmmaker Randy Moore, who oddly enough his name sounds like a person who acted as a Disney princess, not mentioning names there, but you know that it does have this kind of cultish type of following with a lot of people, and especially if you're not careful and you don't remind yourself, this is a company. You know, they bank on this. They the whole way that they can afford to keep this place going is by creating this atmosphere, and it's easy to get caught up in this mentality. And the film, I think, is trying to tackle that in a sense, but it doesn't know exactly how to tackle it. I mean, especially when we get to the evil robots underneath Spaceship Earth.
Oh my gosh, I love that. Okay, so if I ever get to go to Disney, Epcot is definitely someplace that I want to go. Because I've always been fascinated with the structure.
It is. I love Epcot.
As they said in the film, and there's the world's biggest testicle.
It's a very unique thing. But I will say one thing: when you go to Epcot, though, bring very comfortable shoes. It is the largest of the parks, and a lot of walking.
The experimental prototype community of tomorrow.
Yes.
So, okay, for that whole part, I wasn't sure if it was one long hallucination or what the hell is going on during that scene.
I think that was intended to be real. I think that
that was intended to be real.
That is real.
They made a connection to the boss, and somehow the boss was like supposed to tell him to do something at the park that was going to steer him towards.
Well, you're supposed to give his son over after not getting into not getting on Buzz Lightyear. But the thing is, that's in Tomorrowland. That's not in Epcot. It's like, why would he go? Why would he decide after Buzz Lightyear to go all the way to the next park and get
But there was some kind of conspiracy, and then it was somehow connected to the fact that Jim had visited as a child. And,
when the park first opened.
Yeah, when the park first opened, and they'd been watching him his entire life and waiting for him to return. And they were giving him these hallucinations and these visions of this other life that he could have. And then the dome helmet thing. Oh, my God. How cool was that? When it starts coming down and you realize that it's a mini Epcot ball on his head. And he's like, what's happening?
That's a great costume for Halloween or cosplay idea.
Just be that guy.
If everything up to this point that already made me hate amusement parks wasn't enough, the helmet coming down, just the claustrophobia that it made me feel, got to me.
I'm just
As long as you have your tube of Geosporic, man, you're fine. You can get out of there.
You mean the never-ending tube of
Geosporic? Yes, the never-ending stream of goo inside of it.
Now that you bring it up, there was so many sexual double entendres.
Oh yeah,
the spoons all over the picture of the woman.
Just an insane amount of
Like
I couldn't understand the constant reference to. I guess maybe it was supposed to be his sexual repression. He's not getting any at home.
What does that have to do with the evil robots? What does that have to do with cat flu? What does that have to do with half the movie?
Nothing.
And that's why it's a horror film. It leaves these questions unanswered that makes it uneasy. Like the entire film, all I could think was, I feel sick. Why does this make me feel sick?
Well, okay, so there's a movie I want to bring up when talking about this one as kind of a film that kind of does the same thing that this film does. It's called Kiss Me Deadly, directed by Robert Aldrich. If you ever get a chance, check it out. It's really great. But the thing is that Kiss Me Deadly starts off with about a guy who picks up a hitchhiker, and the next morning she's dead. And he's trying to find out why, and it leads, I'm not kidding here, to nuclear scientists. Don't ask how that gets there, but it goes there. But the thing is that it takes all these different turnarounds and these kinds of you don't know what the next scene is going to bring you. And I really dig that about what this film is trying to do. The problem here is, and I don't know about y'all, Jim is the most unlikable person I think I've seen in movies in at least the last 10 years.
He is super unlikable.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be.
He is creepazoid.
Yeah, and it has to be cathartic when he dies a little bit, too.
This must speak to the kind of person that I am. I identified with the guy.
Well, he's
under stress, and he's trying, at least he thinks he's trying, and he's failing, and he doesn't know what to do, and of course he knows that tomorrow the world is over. His world is over.
And you have to look at, he tries every coping mechanism in the book to try to center his person going through this. Because the film starts with him getting this devastating news, and right after that he goes for every coping mechanism that he can get his hands on, whether it be sex or lusting after someone or
copious amounts of alcohol.
Yeah, amounts of alcohol or pleasure or food or what basically whatever he can get his hands on.
And he went so far as to commit one of the cardinal sins of drinking, which is beer before liquor. Never sicker.
Never been sicker, man. You don't do that.
But here's the thing that gets me, though, is that at one point, the French girls who we've been
stalking,
one of them actually offers him an escape. He could escape this life. He could escape his fate. He refuses for no reason whatsoever. I don't get the sense that he ever thought about his family at this moment. With the exception of his daughter. I think the only thing is
the daughter's right there.
Well, and it's also the morality of, let me walk off with these super young girls. No.
Who are probably only interested in me for my credit card.
Could be,
I don't get that at all. Again, the thing is, okay, so let's look at what they do. For the most part, they're going ahead and walking around. They're just having a good time.
Songs in French.
They're
walking around singing Frère Jacques like you do.
Yeah, I'll be honest here. I can definitely that is probably the most realistic thing that I could think of in the film at this point. You know, they're definitely very close to one another. Like I said, I think that they're kind of a couple in themselves. They're there with friends, or they find friends there.
Yeah, they meet up with two, I think, American teenage
boys. No, they're European, definitely European.
No, because they say English, or they speak English, and they're speaking in American accents, because he's like, you know, and he tries to say some French, and it's definitely not like anyone who's learned.
Not accurate.
Yeah. So I think that they're like American guys, and I think that the two girls are either sisters or like same age best friends.
I can see that.
Yeah. I don't think that they're, and I think that the are they together thing, like, you're kind of meant to think, are they together? Because they walk around holding hands all the time, and they're skipping and jumping and stripping off their clothes together.
But that's also very European.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Very European. But you're also, that's also supposed to be part of their sexual appeal. Yeah. Their titillation for him.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I totally understand that.
But we're not really interested in how they see him as much as what he sees in them.
Well, his projection on them is that they're going to think I'm a manly man and I'm a good dad, and they're going to be kind of like attracted to me. And they're embraces still. Like, it's super creepy and gross.
It is very super creepy and gross. But at the same time, when he rejects rejects that one girl's offer, that seals his doom. I mean,
she spits right in his face.
Yeah, and she basically says, look, if you don't come with me, you're dead. I mean, she outright says it to him. And when he says no, she spits, which I lead to think that she knew exactly what she was doing, that she murdered him. I mean, if you really look at it.
Right.
And of course, I think, or maybe I should say that she didn't murder him, because I honestly think he killed himself. And I'll explain why later. But again, the thing is that he had the escape. He could have left. He could have walked away. He could have escaped this doom that he was heading down.
Right. Only for a day, though.
I don't know. Again, the thing is that we're looking at this in abstracts. There's no way that we can look at it on a realistic level. So if he escaped his doom today, it would have been for good. Now, I don't know if he would have been very happy in that life or not. Again, that's not meant to be asked at this point. The thing is, he could have escaped his doom. By him rejecting, he has doomed himself to cat flu. But it's interesting enough that after this incident that he gets abducted by the robots. All of this happens, during the fireworks special at Epcot Center, which
more sexual innuendo.
Yeah, I mean, semen on the ball, which ironically enough is actually a thing. It says
Siemens on the side of it.
Yeah.
Sponsored by. Yeah.
Well, Siemens is the sponsor of the fireworks display, and it is one of the most impressive fireworks displays that you'll ever see. And after it will say presented by Siemens on the ball, which does get a few chortles. But the thing is that I think that's another reason why they decided, hey, if we have to have Siemens somewhere, might as well just go ahead and go all out and make them an official part of this movie.
Let them sponsor the evil robot doctor.
Yeah. But at all top of that, let's be honest here, Siemens, come on. I mean,
well, okay.
Absolutely.
Let's just say,
they are
though,
they're known.
And if you're going to have,
company.
If you're going to study the human condition, what better place?
Than Seaman?
No, than Disney.
Than Epcot.
I know. I'm being facetious there.
But okay, so let's say they are a nefarious corporation, and their day-to-day operations are just a front for running this center in which the robot doctors and their taser-armed henchmen abduct and monitor the brains of various visitors to the park in an attempt to understand the power or even harness the power of imagination.
Speaking of tasers,
right to the balls, crotch.
Right to, but it, was I misinterpreting his reaction? Was almost that of enjoyment as he was getting knocked unconscious.
It appeared that way to me too. In the last seconds before he passed out.
Yes.
Well, it's got to feel good at a certain point, right?
Like, well, that's the only thing that his balls had gotten for what I'll say is probably a few years at this point.
Well,
so
he did lay the crazy lady.
Well, he was kind of blacked out for most of it.
Yeah.
True.
And he was kind of raped. So
he was indeed, yes, by the necklace.
Yeah, so I'm going to say that doesn't count.
Fair enough.
You know, but the thing is that how do I put this? The thing that gets me when it comes to the Epcot stuff is that we actually get to go to Soarin', and he has a hallucination of a woman. In the evil lair, we're talking about the real you, which will come back at the final shot, which for me felt like the ending of The Shining, in the most worst possible way possible. But, you know, the thing is that the naked lady that he sees in Soarin', we see her picture, it's her picture that's in the evil lair, you know, where we're seeing her naked.
Yeah, and it gets the Geosporex squirted all over it, splooged all over it, yeah.
Yeah. We find out that she is what is, I'm to assume, Jim's real wife in this alternate dimension.
Alternate Jim, yeah.
Alternate Jim situation, and they have a daughter. They have a daughter together. Interesting.
Were he to reach maximum self actualization, that's who he would be.
So you think that that we're not only talking about the sense of kind of temporal displacement, but we're also talking about the It's a Wonderful Life syndrome?
Yes.
Interesting.
Up until the finale, where you know he's clearly dead. I was beginning to think that he was a robot too.
I would have thought so too, except that he
stubs his toe, man, and bleeds all over.
Yeah. I'm sorry. There was enough blood. There.
He gets in the pool too, and if a robot, you know, if a robot gets in a pool, that's not going to work out for the robot.
Well, I will say that it's interesting that he did try to commit suicide in the pool. And gets pulled out by the lifeguards.
And that was something I didn't notice until repeat viewings, which was. There's quite a few allusions to his death throughout the film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he tried, in a way,
decapitation, man, it happens all the time.
He did try, I don't want to say he tried to commit suicide, but you got the sense that he would have accepted suicide or accepted death at several places.
Do you think when he's standing on the balcony and he first looks down at the guy, he's thinking about jumping?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think that?
Especially when he's been drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that guy was already there? See, I got this impression that guy was there for him and was there early because he knew he was going to die.
No, he's just the cleanup.
Yeah.
But the
or he's there for somebody else that died.
That bellboy.
Yeah, somebody else died.
Yeah, the bellboy.
Bellboy clearly looked happy as they carted his body away and real Jim shows up. I have to think that he was involved somehow.
Oh, I can help you with your
No. It's just that they're all happy like that.
Listen, when that bellboy saw that super rich guy pull up in his super fancy car with his smoking hot wife, he was like, I'm going to get a good tip from this guy.
Yeah. Good point.
You know where your bread is buttered when it comes to these guys. Yeah. But the thing is that, I don't know, it's like, if only the film would have paid more attention. If we had had more setup, like like when the first day, when he's out on the balcony and he's having the phone call and he looks down, it would have been funny if it were the cleanup crew coming to deal with another body.
They're just constantly in and out.
A mention here or there, you know, a scene just of white hats and white coats just showing up from time to time. Give us some through lines. Give us some continuity. Give us something to tie these things together. Again, I would have been kind of cool with him just doing a greatest hits of urban legends at Disney World, as long as they were able to tie them together to make it feel like it's one cohesive story instead of a bunch of different chopped up stories that don't really mesh together.
And don't forget that right at the end, you get one more, which is the fact that the cleanup guy is telepathic and can make you think you've been on a ride that you never went on.
I don't understand. It's the murderer or the second murderer.
I mean, the boy...
Doomed his dad.
The boy clearly let him die. for a reason.
Although the boy shuts the door, and when they pan back in the morning, the door is ajar.
Well, by that point, the mom opened it. She
no, but before she gets out of bed, they pan over and the door.
Oh no,
is
he I don't know if he actually latched it. I think he just.
You know, you don't know if it clicked.
Yeah, I think that. I don't know. I mean,
I could not say.
I cannot say. All right. So, do we feel that this film, in some way, preys on some of your fears and paranoias when you're at places like this?
Absolutely. That was my final note upon repeat on my most recent viewing, which was that it's almost like the message of the film is the real horror is we do not know what's really going on behind the scenes, but do we really want to know?
Do not want to know.
Absolutely not.
Actually, I do.
I know it's nowhere near as insidious as this film makes it out to be. I personally have never worked at an amusement park, but I know people who have, and I have spent time in some of the backstage areas.
There is there's a really great Cracked.com article. It's six behind the scenes things at Disney that you don't want to know. Yeah. And it's examples like, in order to make sure that the people aren't wearing underwear that shows through their costumes, the people in costumes are sharing underwear. And just weird shit like that that just makes you feel gross.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, there's another YouTube. There's this YouTube guy that was like a former employee of Disney World, kind of giving some of his backstory, you know, some of his war stories, which is actually quite interesting. I don't know the guy's name, but he had actually a whole bunch of different behind the scenes takes and tales about working at Disney World specifically.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting. And like I said, a lot of the behind the scenes stuff I'm actually kind of interested in. In that same sense of kind of wonder, like how is, you know, just how crazy is it there? I mean, it is.
It's got to be super crazy. I mean, you made a comparison earlier that it's more immersive than Vegas. Like they want you to forget more about your real life than Vegas casinos want you to forget about your real life.
Sure.
And I feel like that's like a really good comparison to looking at the psychology behind the way places like this are set up.
Absolutely. And there's whole sections of Disney World and Disneyland that look like France and Spain and Italy and the cuisine served there is authentic and the people are dressed authentically. And it's like, we want you to believe that you have actually
and the fact traveled that you're that somewhere. They take it a step further and it's based on an entertainment brand. So if you're someone who has grown up a fan of Disney movies and Disney characters and TV shows and all of that, and there are many now cadet brands like Pixar and Star Wars and Marvel and all of that, they now want you to go and immerse yourself in that fantasy.
Right. The French, the France that you're seeing is the France from
Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast. Yes, thank you. Not necessarily the real France,
it's sensationalized.
The idealized
version. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is a small world after all, so.
Well,
yes,
it is. That's the charm of Disney. And at the same time, I can definitely understand why people see that as very disturbing.
Yeah.
It's that there is a give and take with that. But I think that, you know, for me at least, it's unique in the sense of you're never going to see anything like this anywhere else on the planet.
Right. And that's kind of like the other thing that I wanted to bring up is could you have made this surreal a film anywhere else?
No. No, that's
surely not.
No place else is as famous to do it.
It's not even just that. It's the way you have to, in order to truly appreciate what it is that Escape from Tomorrow is trying to go for, you have to understand just how meticulous Disney World and Disneyland are in creating the atmosphere it does.
Right.
Like I said, the moment you step onto to Disney property, you become a younger version of yourself.
It's Wonderland. It's like you said, it's imagination. The Imagineers, they reached into your brain and scooped out
psychology. They go into your psychology. Everything is designed at Disneyland in order to evoke a very youthful feeling.
Right.
I can understand why when you go to Disneyland, you're going to see they I think that Walt Disney put it best. This is a place for the young and the young at heart.
Yeah.
And it's not just because, you know, that's what they're going for. They created it specifically to get that. They don't want just the people who want to feel that way. They want to get the people who don't feel that way and make them feel that way.
Right.
And that's how you get the repeat business that they do, and why, you know, they make as much money, and that they out of, I gotta say this when it comes to Disney. If you didn't have it this way, Disney World would shut down, you know, within 1 year. If they couldn't create that immersiveness, if they couldn't get people to shell out the money that they do, the way that they do, it would shut down within a year.
Well, and again, not only that, but how, once you've experienced it, how do you encourage someone to come back and do it all again?
You know, you could just engineer some hybrid dinosaurs and, oh, I'm sorry, wrong movie.
You know, I kind of
give Disney time.
Kind of want to talk about that too, because I saw certain parallels between this film's story and Jurassic Worlds. Like you have the one character who's, he's at this thing where there are all these miraculous sights to see, whether it's like the rides and stuff at Disney, or the fact that, oh my God, real live dinosaurs have been brought back to life. Holy shit. But all he's interested in are girls. There's one, similarity there. And I think kind of like the other one too is imagination run wild. In the case of Jurassic World, it's dreaming up a dinosaur that didn't exist, that probably shouldn't exist in the first place.
Well, that was the subtext too to Jurassic World, because it's brought up at some point, and it's even, you know, it's a meta theory that surrounds the franchise.
Exactly. Now,
which is that those dinosaurs are what we think they are,
that's,
and
what
not
we wanna
the real
see.
Deal.
It's what we want to see, yeah.
Yeah.
And in the case of Escape from Tomorrow, like I said, it's imagination run wild. Now, if we want to try to explain the movie, if you take the Occam's razor approach, which is the simplest answer has to be the truth, it's that this guy is having a mental breakdown, and everything that he sees and experiences is a result of some type of delusion or paranoid, break that he's having in his brain. And so he's dreaming up all of these things, like the cat flu and the robots and the witch and all of that, to help, like, because he's undergoing that process.
Well, and I got the feeling that he was sick, that he may have had the cat, because the nurse even says it, you might be a carrier and not even know it. Something was going on well before he got spit in the face.
Right.
To figure out why did the nurse break down after?
Let me explain what I think.
Yeah.
And maybe this will clarify, or maybe a little confound. I don't know. But for me, and this is why I say that I think that in a way he did commit suicide. We mentioned that Disney is a place of imagination and magic. I don't know if she ever said cat flu. You know, and here's one of the reasons why I say this. She's the only person at Disney that is unhappy. She's the only person that we see that doesn't have a smile on her face. Even the guy, even the cleanup crew have smiles on their faces.
Yeah.
She's the only one that shows anything less than just cheerful repose.
What's in those lollipops she's given out, man?
She's the only one dealing in reality in a fake world.
Perhaps. You don't think the people that are cleaning up the blood and the corpse are dealing in reality? Or is it because they're telepaths or whatever?
I think they were Siemens robots.
Oh, they're more robots than
That
was
like
my
robots.
Theory.
Yeah.
Honestly, I just think that they've just done it a long time. But the reason why I say he committed suicide was that she planted the seed of the cat flu.
Cat flu.
He, and understand that this entire place has warped his mind when it comes to believing in the imagination and the magic of the place. Remember that on the rides, he's seeing a lot of animatronics. He's seeing a lot of robots.
And he's hallucinating that they're demons, too.
Yes. So would it be so far as to think that during a particular blackout that he finds himself in a lair where he is he believes that he is under duress of an evil robot, when in fact it could be that he's just in an infirmary, or that he his mind is just kind of slipping. And bear in mind that he's also under the stress that he had lost his daughter, and he's terrified he can't find her. And she finds herself happening to be in the place of the former princess, we'll call her that. I don't know. It's just like, again, it all feels like David Lynch. It feels like and we're talking about like the stuff about David Lynch that frustrates me. It's like, we don't have to explain. All it has to do is just look weird and look cool.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this is going for. And I don't know. It's like, I mean, I respect the fact that he's doing his best David Lynch, but I don't even like David Lynch doing this David Lynch thing. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a personal thing.
And there's a moment there at the end with the whole situation, that whole third act bit where he can't find his daughter. You know, as a parent, it's just a horrifying thought. But throughout the movie, they make the point that the daughter is scared of the witch from Snow White. She is dressed as a witch, and she's having the time of her life. By the end of it, there's like, I almost feel like it was not given enough time. Again, mm-hmm. Was the daughter is no longer scared of the witch.
Right.
Well, she and breaks she the witch's up, spell.
Right. She does. Yeah. And again, like, I feel like this movie is so ambitious and yet limited, yes, not only by scope, but in the time allotted. It's only 90 minutes. They were limited how much they could do. And the fact that they were able to cram in so much and leave, I mean, honestly, we probably wish that there was another half hour of film and another act to the movie where we get some answers.
No, just 10 minutes just to tie things up. I don't want answers for this movie, because yeah, I think that in a way, keeping it with this kind of mystery, is it real, is it not real?
Sure.
I respect that. I just want them to tie this together, just to create a narrative that binds these together. And I'd say that the real problem with the movie that I have is the fact that it, as ambitious as this film is, it doesn't seem to understand that much about storytelling. And that's something that frustrates me, just as someone who loves stories as much as I do, because...
Maybe, but I mean, you understand everyone's motivations enough that at no point does anyone really act out of character, and sort of the situational, you get to see them react to situations around them, some of which we, you know, find rather hard to believe, like the robot.
But the situations change so radically.
Well, there's a lot going on there.
It's not that it's not going, that it's all going on. It's like the story changes. Like, it's almost like he's jumping from a comic book to a comic book from time. You know, it's like, you know,
well,
one moment he's in a robot invasion. Next moment he's in a post-apocalyptic
genre.
Well,
jumping.
Okay. Let's dial it back a second and talk about other literary works in which this kind of things occur. Is this an odyssey? Is he on an odyssey through Disney that takes him from like almost like a Gulliver's Travels? He goes from the land of the giants to the land of the tiny people to the land of the talking horses.
I'd be very careful, because Gulliver's Travels is giving you a clear, with each person he meets, is meeting a specific goal. He's meeting a specific next step of the ladder. You talk about the Odyssey. One event leads to the other on this kind of narrative that is bound together by certain elements that tie all of these different motifs together.
Well, and there are ties in this one, like, we know that, well, while he was captured by the robot, the witch took his daughter. So we assume that there's some kind of a connection there.
But
well, that they're at least aware that each other are operating in the same space and have negotiated a relationship that suits their individual ends.
But we don't ever get a clear definition of that.
No, we don't, because he dies of cat flu.
It's not just that. It's like, but the thing is that even if there was just even small little things, you know, what I'll call Mass Effect little tidbits, where it's somewhere in the foreground or something in the background, I would be more than receptive to it. But the problem here is that it doesn't even give us that. You're saying that there's a connection, but it's speculative at best. It's created by the person's interpretation. It's not because the film gives us something to make that leap from one to the other.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it would be kind of dull if it did give you all the answers up front, right? I mean, so then what's there to watch?
Not answers, just ties, just something to branch these things together and to show that the vision is cohesive, that it's meant to lock together. And
that's where the Gulliver's Travel metaphor breaks down, because in Gulliver's Travels, every experience he goes through was teaching him a lesson. He came out of it a smarter, more well-rounded person. And in this, Jim doesn't learn shit. Jim doesn't evolve. He's
right.
And the one time he does make the wise choice of not going off with the girls, it wasn't because he was doing the right thing. It was out of fear.
Yeah.
But then if you take the approach that this is someone losing their mind, if you're losing your mind, your paranoid delusions aren't going to make you a better person. You're devolving into madness. So by going through the subsequent mental break, each step that he goes through is breaking down another part of his very soul.
I have to wonder what happened the first few days of the vacation. Myself.
Honestly, the work that I would compare this to the most is probably Dante's Inferno, where he's going through these various circles of hell in his de-evolution into his final punishment.
But even there, the ties between the different levels of hell are clearly defined and are marked. Here we don't even get it. It's not that he's even going deeper into hell. There's various levels. I mean, the evil robots is very different from the evil wannabe princess. You know,
they're all different than guy in cart who keeps hitting everyone and going, "Oh, was that me? Oh, my son didn't mean to knock your daughter down and injure her."
So, yeah, if it were going further and further down the rabbit hole, down into the nightmare, I would respect that, and I would agree. I mean, hell, that's what Videodrome does, and that's one of my all-time favorite horror movies, because it does give you that we're getting worse and worse. It's getting worse and worse and worse, and Escape from Tomorrow doesn't do that. If it did it, I would have been a huge fan of it. Which I guess is giving my hand away a little bit on this one. But
Actually, you know what's odd when it comes to that question? When you say, "Oh, what does it remind you of?" You know, it kind of reminds me of Mallrats. Just keep wandering the same area, running into the same people, and just weird stuff happens in particular places. But
so here's my take. It's said about. And I don't know if this quote originated with like New York, but there are a million stories in the naked city, right? So there are a million stories in the naked theme park, whether it's the witch, the robots, the Asian businessmen, the French girls, the telepathic cleaners, the emu legs, you know, you could kind of go on and on and on about all of this stuff that's kind of like going on either behind the scenes or right in front of you, and you just don't see it because you're focused on just enjoying your time, and there's lots to distract you. So to me, that's kind of what this film represents, and that's kind of what they're saying. Again, like the title Escape from Tomorrow, it kind of has a Westworld type vibe, like you're on the ride and everything starts to go wrong. And then you kind of have to escape from this theme park horror once things go bad.
But the tomorrow in the title is not about escaping the theme park. Escape from tomorrow. I mean, if you really think about it, escape from tomorrow is escape from reality, because tomorrow he's leaving the park.
Right.
Tomorrow he has to face the reality of the fact that he doesn't have a job. Tomorrow,
and for what it's worth, he does escape. It's not pretty. It's not pleasant. But at the end, he goes through all of this, and the Jim that we have gotten to know throughout the film does not have to face the next day. We are introduced, however, at the end of the film to a new Jim who is probably better prepared to meet whatever life is going to throw at him next. And that's...
I don't know, he's wearing a fedora. That's not a good sign for any character that is outside of Indiana Jones.
That was a Trilby, but equally
fair,
bad.
Fair point. But I think it's kind of interesting. So again, I'm going to take the pragmatist view and say that all of his visions and experiences, that's all hallucinatory. And at the end, he has emerged a different Jim. The old Jim is now dead. And this new guy has a much stronger self-concept. He has a much stronger, I don't even know what the, a je ne sais quoi. I don't want to use more French, but.
Did he earn it though?
You know, and that's kind of the thing that you have to ask yourself when it comes to stuff like this.
Well, because we're talking about metamorphosis at this point, right? Because his old self is dead, a new self arrives. That's a metamorphosis. In a metamorphosis story, the whole point of it is that he learns enough that he can ascend, kind of Buddhist-like, to a higher self. Does he actually do that?
I mean, you kind of have to think about the various facets of his life that aren't working for him. And then if you look at the final, you know, if you look at Jim 2.0 has what we assume is a very sexually available wife who dresses skimpy and is clearly very attracted to him and all of that. Jim 2.0 has a daughter, but not a son.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting when you consider the relationship between Jim and his son and then how Jim kind of bonds with his daughter. And Jim 2.0 clearly has a much more self-confident disposition about him.
Oh, you made me think of something. I'm sorry, I have to bring this up. Okay, there's a moment in the movie when Jim's first wife, or wife one, Emily, what we think is a hallucination where she says that the little boy is not his son.
Yeah.
Now let's take that back to what the scientist says about the fact that, you know, that isn't your real family. This isn't even the real you.
Yeah.
That's the real you. They didn't say anything about the daughter. So are we led to believe that the daughter was his, the wife and the son aren't his?
Yeah.
Then why is his wife showing up in Soren naked and splayed out? I mean,
I only just thought of this in the last 2 or 3 minutes. It almost feels like everything that happens prior to Jim 2.0 showing up at the end was Jim 2.0's nightmare.
It could be. Could totally be.
He's sleeping. Yeah. He's sleeping in the car on the way to Disneyland, and it's like a fever dream.
Yeah.
And he wakes up and
it's not a wonderful life.
But he's driving, so that would actually be kind of scary in its own right.
It's a waking daydream.
He was asleep on the plane, ride.
You could look at it the other way, which is Jim 1.0 is systematically destroying everything throughout the experience and then ending with himself. Because he, you know, presumably destroys the relationship with his wife, destroys the relationship with his son, destroys the aspects of his personality, and probably literally everything that defines him. And at the end, like, the Phoenix is reborn.
Now I demand that Disney remake, because...
Okay, let's talk about
it's
that.
It's just weird. Yeah.
I guess final thoughts on this film. We'll do the remake and then our review.
Yeah, let's. I want to give Jesse a chance to take the lead on this one, considering that this is his pick. On top of that, what did you learn from your experience with Art House Legends in this madhouse that you voluntarily signed up for?
I love the show, and I'm so happy that I got to be involved, because over the 2 years that I've been listening to y'all, you have just broadened my scope of understanding about movies and movies that I would have never encountered before. And so finally having an opportunity to discuss a movie that for me was really branching out. Let's be honest. I do not watch these kinds of films. I usually avoid them, but it piqued my interest, the whole guerrilla film style. So like you guys are just as in terms of movie knowledge leaps and bounds beyond me. And I've just learned a lot about movies in general. I pay more attention now to things like directors and scores and cinematography. And this movie did all of those things. Sadly, while the ultimate final edit maybe got a little screwed up in execution, it did things like music and the filming and the casting. It did those things correctly. I'll put it that way. Ultimately, no matter what we ultimately decide about the film itself, this, I will never ever forget this film because of what it did right. Much it like... made me feel things that I didn't want to feel, but I'm happy that I felt them, and I will watch this movie again and again. I will philosophize about this movie for the rest of my life.
I'd even go so far as to say I won't forget the thing for the things they do wrong, too.
Much like Eric won't ever forget The Man Who Knew Too Little.
Yeah.
And who made him watch it.
I've been trying to forget that movie. I've gotten close to forgetting the movie. I'm still never going to forget who made me watch that movie. But
let's take a step outside ourselves and imagine a world in which Disney has decided to embrace what this film represents and make their own version of Escape from Tomorrow. Again, it's easy for them. They own the theme park. Let's say their stock took a downturn. They need to save some cash. So why not make a big budget movie with whoever they can get using their own theme park as the set?
What, Frozen 3 won't save them?
They
need to release it under the Touchstone label.
Star Wars 15 came out, and it's just not doing it. It was only number one at the box office for 5 weeks.
I'd say they'd make all their money back just in the merchandising alone. Get the Epcot hats or the Epcot,
yeah, the Epcot helmets for everybody. Helmets. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Not just that, but let's go with the cock tasers while we're at it.
The
tasers, you know, zap it, you know. But on top of that, you know, we need to get the Geosporin. I mean,
that's exactly right. I was just
God. Brilliant.
All right. So
just that in itself, it would save
Walt. It would totally it would put him in the black for sure. Jesse, who do you want in your Disney sanctioned remake of Escape from Tomorrow? Let's start with Jim.
You know, you would ask and suddenly I wouldn't be able to think of anything.
only one name. Nicolas Cage was dropped
earlier. I can't argue with that. If I think of something better.
Just him with the helmet. Come on. I mean, I know that the some people might start saying bees, but come on. That's like just perfect. I want to see that. In fact, I think I'm actually going to find a way to do like put Nicolas Cage in Escape from Tomorrow, getting the helmet on, you know.
Nicolas Cage in the helmet yelling bees.
Yes.
In the Disney sanctioned remake, if for no other reason than to because the movie itself is already meta. Yeah. It's so meta. To make a Nicolas Cage meta joke within the meta movie would be a dream.
It would break the internet. The internet would die just from the overextension that would cause right there.
What are you doing to me? Are you inside my head? Bees!
I think I want Nathan Fillion to be my Jim.
Oh.
In this film, because I'm gonna say they're gonna do this as kind of like a screwball comedy, madcap style. Tom Hanks will probably be a bit old, otherwise I'm sure that they would put Tom Hanks.
He's the guy in the wheelchair or the scooter.
No, he might have to be my evil robot.
Alec Baldwin.
I'm with you on the evil robot
in the wheelchair.
Alec Baldwin.
You know, the fat suit from Primary Colors.
Yeah.
And a bad Cajun accent. If we're going madcap screwball, Alec Baldwin for the fat guy.
And
we have to have Tina Fey as Emily, right? Because
oh my God. Tina Fey. I got an Amy Poehler vibe, but sure, you know, keep it.
Well, he mentions Tina Fey that she looks like that she's as cute as Emily Dickinson or maybe Tina Fey.
Oh god, that is pretty great.
Again, another meta joke. It's Tina Fey. You know, honey, you kind of like Ocean's 12 with Julia Roberts.
Oh, you know what? Actually, for Jim though, Will Arnett.
Oh my god!
No! That's just too on the nose. That's too on the nose. I mean, next we're gonna be saying that it's gonna be crap. I forgot his
Christina
name.
Applegate.
Star Lord. Whatever.
Chris Pratt.
Yeah.
No. I think Will Arnett could play a good Jim. That's I was trying to think of an actor that I could see and like going the what? No, I'm not. And that's like Will Arnett's catchphrase.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. It's just too on the nose. It's like, this is exactly what Will Arnett would play.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I got it. I got it. Well, right. For Jim and Emily, we get Jim and Pam from The Office.
I knew you were going to go there. I don't know what it is. I feel
last couple weeks, you've been like able to read
John Krasinski right in there. Keep him in everything.
He could work in Dune.
He could work in this. Fisher,
so.
Yeah.
Except for a guy in wheelchair, I'm oh great, now my brain just fried and I can't remember the great actor's name.
name the movie. How
Everything Good.
Morgan Freeman.
Everything Good. Oh, John Goodman.
Yeah, because he can do the accent. And
yeah, it's too on the nose. I mean,
yeah,
guy in the wheelchair is a little creepier than that when he's like licking the ice cream cone and looking at her.
How's your daughter?
Yeah.
I want Christoph Waltz as the German scientist. Role.
Yes. Oh my god.
Yes, I would pay money for that.
Mr. Bond, we just have to put the laser in your brain, Mr. Bond, and then you'll forget everyone. Oh, that's pretty good.
All right, are we ready to call it? I think.
wait a second though, Eric. I wanted to put you on the spot with something.
What?
Did Disney already make their big budget remake of this film and call it Tomorrowland?
I did think about that. I'm going to say no, because and I know that I am like in the strong minority on this one. I actually think Tomorrowland's kind of good.
Yeah.
Tomorrowland was Disney giving the finger to this movie.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Anything
think
you
so.
Can do, I can do better. Is that what they did with that?
Kind of.
Yeah. Here's your version of our park. Now here's our version of our park.
Yeah. I'll go that way. I'll tell you one thing. I want the Tomorrowland version of the Disney World Park. That would just be too awesome.
All right.
All right, we're ready to call it?
I think my fast pass has expired. I can't jump any more lines.
Okay. Kent, Lobster, Jesse, do you agree with the critics that Escape from Tomorrow sucks the big ball? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Jesse.
I'm going to fail it. And as much as I enjoy it, as much as I enjoy this movie, as we've discussed to death tonight, it's for as much as it got right in terms of good horror, it did so many things wrong. And like I said, I'll never forget it and I'll watch it again. But were the critics right? Yes.
Lobster.
Oh, okay. Art, making art is about taking risks. And this movie takes every risk, not only in the way in which it was actually filmed, which when you look at it, it could have resulted in them getting kicked out of the park. Disney could have confiscated all of their work. Disney could have sued the pants off of them, and subjected them to years of costly litigation. Disney elected to actually just pretty much ignore it.
And hope it went away quiet.
Yeah, and basically it's the Streisand effect. Like, we're just going to ignore this and hope it goes away and not give it any more publicity than we need to, which is kind of the opposite of what CBS is doing right now with Star Trek X-Nar, in the fact that they're suing the pants off of them, and thus getting them lots of attention for their project. But, literally this film took every risk, not only in the physical, logistical making of it, but in the storytelling. And the fact that you could have chosen to tell any type of film at Disney World, because again, I believe that that, like places like New York City and Paris, and that's one of the geographic centers in the world for telling stories, because there are a million stories there that you can tell. And this film takes every risk in the type of story that it's going to tell. And I think at the end of the day, just like we have spent the past hour and a half trying to dissect exactly what type of story are we being told in this film, speaks to the level of storytelling that this film achieves, which is not necessarily to tell one cohesive narrative beginning to end, but to tell a multifaceted story, which may or may not be telling us one cohesive story from beginning to end. So it might be about Jim going crazy and all of the stuff that his brain cooks up. It might be about him reinventing himself, or it might be the fever dream of the real Jim, imagining what his life would have been like if he'd been kind of a wuss and a spineless moron. Or at least not fully self-actualized, I guess, you know, you could say whatever. Or it's a horror movie. It's, something that preys on our deepest fears, and insecurities in a place, of ultimate happiness. Because can anyone really be that happy? I give this film a pass. And in the spirit of Art House Rejects, where we have looked at films that have kind of been panned, I'm giving it a pass to say, I don't quite think that it deserves being judged the way that we judge even films like, The Man Who Knew Too Little and Dune, which are made with the backing of a studio. This was just made by some people who, I believe Randy Moore ended up using, the inheritance that he got from a deceased relative to make this movie. And if that's what he decided to do with that money, then like that's not getting money from a studio saying, go and make this movie. That's not, you know, getting a budget. That's a passion project. And the fact that this is the end result of that, to me, is so fascinating. And so for me, this film is a pass. I think that if certainly if you're a fan of anything Disney related, you owe it to yourself to watch this. If you're a fan of horror and thriller and that kind of thing, or I think if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you should take a look at this and just imagine the possibilities.
Kent,
I admire the back attempt of the guerrilla filmmaking. I really do. Just the ability to get in there, make a movie, and nobody knows you're making a movie is amazing. I mean, you don't have anybody reporting to security, hey, these guys are doing something weird. And they pull off this entire film. The problem with the film is that it just is too confusing, I think, for what's going on. They don't well explain. It breaks down with just, like, we're still arguing, what is going on here? Who is Jim? What is Jim? And, it doesn't work in the end. It's an A for effort, but it needed a better script, I think, going into this. And I feel bad about it, but I gotta fail it. And I wish I could give it better, but I feel bad. I know they attempted something amazing and it just fell flat.
Now I feel bad for failing it.
Yeah.
You should all feel bad, goddammit.
Yeah. All right, so I mentioned earlier that this is not a movie. This is actually proof of interdimensional travel. Okay. And I think that I kind of made some of my points earlier, but I'll go ahead and I'll just put it more clearly. I firmly believe that Randy Moore didn't actually... I think he directed maybe a sixth of this movie. And then he went to other dimensions to other Randy Moores and gathered their stuff, and he spliced it all together. You know, one Randy Moore directed a horror film. One Randy Moore directed a family drama. Another Randy Moore directed a sci-fi thriller. And he just put these things all together, spliced them all together into one particular narrative, if you want to call it a narrative. How do I put this?
It was a story told in editing.
That's true. And there are other movies that have been told in editing. One that I think we'll get to at some point is Annie Hall. If you knew what the original story was and you see the final outcome, you're surprised. You'll be surprised completely because it was never intended to be the way it was.
Pretty Woman.
That's another one. Now, I'm gonna say something. I don't want this to sound controversial, but it might come off as this. But I'm gonna say, you gotta see it. You have to see this.
Gotta watch.
Get through the pervy parts. And trust me, it is hard to get through the pervy parts because it is disgusting. But you've got to see just how batshit crazy this thing is. Mm-hmm. This is like, you know, your twisted ex-girlfriend times 20 kind of batshit crazy, okay? And for that, you gotta see it.
But Disney Princess Fallen from Grace, kind of crazy.
We're talking about the 30 years past their prime Disney Princess type. But that said, this thing is insane, and not in the good way either. This has got some of the most ADD-ish storytelling I think I've seen in a modern movie. The through lines don't match. Nothing ever comes to a conclusion. Even the death of our character really doesn't even conclude anything. I think that there's a lot of great ideas, but I think that at the same time it's just hampered by the fact that that there's no clear idea of what they want to do with the final to bind these together. Like I said, it feels like it was picked from like several different stories and put together. Maybe it's because they were worried that they didn't have something, or maybe they had brilliant ideas like halfway through shooting and they thought, oh, well, let's put this in here and let's put that in there. Or maybe they just didn't have the sets and they were just trying to stitch it together the best they could. It could be a bunch of different things. I mean, half of the movie was not even shot at Disney. You can tell the green screens. You could tell the obvious sets that, you know, that were used that weren't a part of Disney. A lot of that was there. So, you know, what parts did they go into Disney with one idea and then come out of Disney with other ideas? I definitely got the feeling that they did the Disney stuff first and then decided to make the movie around that, which definitely can... It makes a lot of sense. But if you take just the Disney stuff, the stuff that you know was clearly done at Disney... you got the sense that this was a drama, that there was a drama story being told here. The fantastical parts, the freaky freak out stuff, all of that stuff was the non-Disney stuff. And I feel like part of me wants to just cut all the Disney things out and take that stuff and see what kind of narrative you can make just with the Disney stuff. But overall though, this is weird, and I say go ahead and see it. But
yes, definitely see this.
Yes.
And let's talk about where it's available, because this is kind of hard to find.
No, because it's on Amazon Prime. It's on
Netflix.
It's on Netflix, but you're not going to get it, I don't think, out of Redbox, right?
Oh, no.
Well, I think it was at Redbox.
Was it?
In some places. I mean, you have to understand, this is a very indie movie, so yeah. It's not going to be in every Redbox.
I found it at Best Buy. On a rack of five.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
The week it came out.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Because I kind of got the impression that they were not trying to hide it, but going for kind of like the low-key approach to releasing it.
It's a limited distribution because I don't think there's a lot of people that are going to go see this. And I think that in a way it's smart because if they make it too big, if they get too much attention, then the mouse will come after them.
If it looks like they have any money.
Yeah, at this point, like I said, eke out maybe a few $1,000s. Disney doesn't care. That's, you know, that's what they pay, you know, their servants to wipe their asses. You very start true. To look at, you know, making this into a big deal. You make this into like a Rocky Horror thing. Oh, they're going to take their cut. But yeah, as long
do you see a future where this is a cult film?
Yes,
I would love it for Disney to embrace it, kind of like with the Nightmare Before Christmas. I mean,
they have a little bit. It's on their Disney A to Z online kind of glossary of Disney stuff. They've made very, very like restrained acknowledgement of it.
It's Disney trivia.
It is.
Yeah, I think it falls squarely under the, again, to connect it to a Disney IP, oddly enough, one based on a Disney ride, but you have heard of it.
Yeah. I'm going to say this. I'm going to design an Epcot hat or an Epcot helmet.
Yes.
Go into Disney and just see how far I get before
you won't need to put sunscreen on your head because it'll block it. Yeah. You know.
This is
Florida.
Yeah, but it's Florida, which means you'll pass out like after
it'll be like a little greenhouse for your head.
Actually, if you have a tube for water coming right up to your mouth and you're just constantly drinking so you can regulate temperature.
I just wonder how many people will think I'm Daft Punk. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
But
I do feel like that there would be room for a sequel.
To establish
what happened to
Jim 1.0's family.
The Escape from Tomorrow cinematic universe, where you go and follow a different family and you see some of the stuff.
I think an anthology would be kind of a cool thing for
like
this.
You see some of the stuff that goes on and they mention cat flu, but thank God it's been cured and no.
Cat flu is its own thing. It's not that there's no cure. I don't think that he died really officially of cat flu. I think that his imagination killed him by him thinking that it's cat flu.
Wait, no. Curiosity killed him. Curiosity killed the cat.
Zing!
Okay, any war puns?
No, but I do kind of want to briefly do our geek sheet with this. Now, again, this is a cast of mostly unknowns. There aren't a lot of people who you're going to find links to from IMDb and things like that. However, Annette Mahendru, who plays one of the, we're told that they're French girls, but Annette is actually an Afghan-born Russian-Indian-American actress. Well known for her role on the FX series The Americans, which she's been nominated for a Critics' Choice Television Award for Best Supporting Actress. She's done a bunch of stuff. She's done film. Besides this, she's done a lot of TV. Most recently, she will be playing a role on The X-Files, which premieres right now, actually, kind of as we're talking. So she's out there. So there is at least one member of the cast who has broken out.
Go for you. I think the character that I remember her from was in Blacklist. She was in the pilot for that.
Yep, she's on Blacklist. Yep, she's been on a bunch of stuff.
Which all of this happened before Escape from Tomorrow. So, you know, take that for what it is.
Well, good for her.
Yeah.
That's all excellent. Right.
So at this point, is there anything else that we need to bring up?
Are we done rejecting movies? Are we going to go back to good, quote unquote, good movies?
Well, it is Oscar season.
Noah, we asked if we were going to get to good movies. Ooh!
You know what? It's so funny. We had a bunch of snow here. And somebody told me that all the Oscar nominees were standing outside. And I looked out and I couldn't see any of them because it was so white.
It was all white.
So funny.
Whiter
that.
Than Oscar, yeah.
Whiter than, that was the Daily Mail, right?
We're going to have some fun.
Yeah, we
season.
Are. We are. I promise you that our discussion of Oscar-related films will be more diverse than the current slate of nominees.
Yeah.
Well, let's say one of the films that we're doing this Oscar season is definitely on the more diverse side. So I'm really excited about all of the ones that we're going to be doing this month, including our Valentine's Day episode, which I've actually been dying to talk about this movie for a long time, and especially with two. Have y'all seen Once Before?
Have I seen it once before, or how many times have I seen it? I've seen it nuns.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about you, Jesse? Have you seen Once?
Sadly, I've not even heard of it.
Oh, this is gonna be great. All right, so yes, that is
I have a feeling that we'll be falling slowly towards a discussion of that film.
Well, I will seek it out.
I think our next episode is going to be something quite interesting because I know that it was just recently Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and I know that February is known for being African American History Month. So how about we tackle some African American history, especially a particular bridge and a particular well-known civil rights leader?
Sure.
And a particularly well-known Oscar winner from last year. Let's do Selma.
Let's do it.
All right, so that is our next episode. I hope that you'll join us for that. It's going to be a very exciting discussion, and we'll be discussing more of the films that we'll be doing in February on our next episode. So,
Jesse, thank you.
Thank you, guys. This scratched an itch for me that has been lingering since I first saw the movie. Thank you. It's been satisfied. I feel like I can shut the door because you gave me some things to think about, and you guys certainly gave me some perspective that I didn't have before.
Well, I hope that you'll keep listening, though.
Oh, I will absolutely keep listening.
No, we're dead to him now. as a fan of the podcast, would you encourage other fans to be brave and reach out to us?
Oh, absolutely. If you listen to this show and you want to discuss with these guys, because if you're anything like me, you're talking to the radio while it's on anyway. I feel like I participate in the discussion every week, even if I'm not really there. So you guys have been great and accommodating, and thank you again for having me. And do another contest like this. I would love to hear another podcast noob or just another listener come along and have some fun with you guys. Thank you again.
Well, we thank you for your support and your dedication to sticking with us from our early days.
Yes. All right, so let's go ahead and let's close this up. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
This is John O'Lobster.
And I am Jesse.
And get out of here.
Thank you for listening. If you want to leave us feedback, go to gunnageek.com and you will find all of our contact information and other shows. The music heard on this podcast is by Kevin MacLeod and can be found at incompetech.com. The opinions heard on this podcast are those of the individual host and do not represent Legend Stream Canada or Gunna Geek. No infringement is intended.
I feel like I want to hear Ellen DeGeneres say Escape from Tomorrow.